Coming up on Tech Nation, we go back to the polio epidemic of the 1950s in the United States and the breakthrough vaccine of Dr. Jonas Salk. I speak with Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, Professor Emerita at Stanford University School of Medicine and author of Jonas Salk, A Life. Then on Biotech Nation, we talk about Meniere's disease and how a venture capitalist was diagnosed with the condition and right there on the spot decided there should be better treatment options. The result is the company called Autonomy. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
When society solves a big problem, sometimes caused by technology in the first place, you tend to forget about it. Take air pollution, for example. In cities, you used to be able to see it, taste it, almost chew it. It got so bad. As a kid in nascent Silicon Valley, I could look across and see with photo clarity the brown hills bordering its western edge. They had a crispness through the crystal clear air and paint blue sky that seemed a permanent backdrop to the stretches of orchards just starting to be dotted by budding suburban housing tracts. But as with all things in life, there was nothing permanent about it, and Silicon Valley began to roar. By the 1970s, there were so many cars that you entered the valley and you couldn't see the hills. You saw gray and perhaps the faint outline of ridges. San Jose was no better off than Los Angeles or any crowded city in California in those days. Everyone was in their own gas-guzzling car, each spewing emissions at a rate which would be considered appalling today. And then we ran out of gas. I mean literally, ran out of gas. For the first time ever, Californians experienced a gas crisis. We had the temerity to think that we produced all the gas we would ever want, and suddenly we learned a four-letter word, OPEC, O-P-E-C, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which managed the available world supply of oil and in turn could control prices. It's what's called a cartel, which means a bunch of folks get together to set prices high and squash competition. These were all new words in this post-World War II society, which thought it was a master of the world and controlled its own destiny. But there we were. You could only get 7 gallons of gas at a time, and even then, only every other day, depending on whether your license plate ended in an even or an odd number. There were long lines at the gas station at a time before cell phones and your favorite music personally piping into your ears. There was plenty of time to contemplate why you were spending half an hour in line trying to get some gas and why OPEC would shut gas down to a trickle. But there were also pleasant surprises. I remember driving down US 101, past Moffett Field, and looking up. And there were the western hills of my youth and the clear blue skies. And I thought, this isn't so bad after all. In no time, catalytic converters, unleaded gas, and high mileage standards kicked in, the forerunners of our hybrid cars and diamond lanes, not to mention working from home. Today, seeing hills is the norm, while the valley has never been more jammed with people and their tech dreams. China might easily learn from all this, as their explosion of automobiles and semi-regulated factories reflect these same techno-society growing pains. This time, it's not OPEC, but rather APEC, which stands for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. When APEC met in the fall of 2014 in Beijing, factories were closed and automobiles limited, and the result was a no-smog APEC blue sky. The next spring, the same trick worked for Parade Blue to celebrate China's defeat of Japan in World War II. You see, when you take half of the 500 million cars in Beijing off the road, well, heck, there's a clue to the solution. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we look back at polio in mid-century America, and I speak with Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, the author of Jonas Salk, A Life. Then on Biotech Nation, we talk about Meniere's disease and how a venture capitalist decided there should be better treatment options right from his initial diagnosis. The front end of the baby boomers were young kids of 5, 6, 7, and 8 in 1955, and they can remember summers when they weren't allowed to go swimming at public swimming pools. Their parents lived in fear, and the word polio was on everyone's lips. I asked Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, the author of Jonas Salk, A Life, why.
Well, I lived through that. It even preceded 1955. The first major epidemic in the United States was in 1916, and by 1952 it had really peaked. So that's when a lot of the fear escalated. You were prohibited by your parents often from going to swimming pools, movie theaters. One was a little worried. And there were pictures of polio spread across newspapers and magazines, and even the newsreel before the main attraction in the theater had pictures of children struggling with braces and rooms full of iron lungs, people who couldn't use their arms or their legs. It was a very fearful time. And what made it more fearful was that no one knew which town or which city was going to have an outbreak. Not only that, none of us knew which child the crippler would attack next. And that was a lot of the fear.
If a child were to contract polio, what happened?
Okay. So it gets into the child through the mouth, often from fecal material that's everywhere. The polio virus multiplies in the lymph nodes in the mouth and throat and then down into the gastrointestinal tract. At that time, the child might have a little queasiness and might have a little runny nose, a bit of a cough, pretty innocuous. From there, it spreads into the bloodstream. And at that point, the child spikes a fever, becomes very restless. And if it gets over the next few days into the central nervous system, then the child has the electric shocks spreading throughout the arms and legs, muscle spasms twisting the child into awkward positions, and then the sudden onset of weakness. And no one could predict which arm or leg or both arms or both legs would be affected. From there, if it spread into the base of the brain, then the child would have trouble breathing, couldn't swallow, couldn't talk, couldn't even swallow his or her own saliva, and sometimes drowned in that saliva, and couldn't breathe. And those were the children put in the iron lung. Fortunately, the majority of people that were exposed to the polio virus either didn't know because they weren't that sick, it just seemed like they had a cold, or had went on to develop weakness, a third of which improved, so that the percentage who had devastating side effects or who went on to die was a smaller percentage. But for example, in 1916, in the first big epidemic, 27,000 had paralysis and 6,000 died. The tragedy is most of those were children.
Now, it wasn't just children who contracted polio?
No, adults could get polio as well, but many adults had immunity that they had gotten throughout the years because before we had such great sanitation, the polio virus did exist in the water supply. And adults, when they were children, may have been exposed to very low doses of the polio virus and never had the disease, but achieved lifelong immunity. So really, in the United States and in other countries, as the sanitation improved, outbreaks of polio began to occur because people had not been exposed and were not protected.
Now, in this peak of, you know, the early 1950s, what did they understand about polio? What did they get wrong? What did they suspect? What did they know?
Interestingly, a lot of what was known about polio was found by a few physicians during the 1916 epidemic. Right at the start. The entire clinical course was laid out. There were misconceptions about how it spread. For example, in New York City, which had a major brunt of the epidemic in 1916, all the cats were rounded up and exterminated because they thought cats brought polio. But by 1955, they did know that it came through the oral route. That was known. It was known that it got into the bloodstream. That meant if you had a vaccine that caused you to produce antibodies, you could block the virus in the bloodstream. So that was a very important thing known about it. It was known that it predominantly occurred in the summer. That's when all the outbreaks were, and the virus seemed to go into hiding in the fall and winter. It was known to attack mainly children. So those were some of the things. Jonas Salk was involved very early on with research that was funded through the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. And one of the very most important first things they did was find out how many different types of virus there were. So, for example, in smallpox, there's only one type of smallpox. And so that when you make a smallpox vaccine, great, that's it. But in polio, they didn't know, was there one or were there 1,000 different types of polio? And they did a major undertaking and found that there were 3 types of polio. So that, plus the knowledge that it spread through the bloodstream, were the findings that led the way to the polio vaccine.
And they did all this without computers, modern laboratories, massive data collection and analytics.
That was the there are two things that I think are absolutely noteworthy about the whole polio era. The first is that Jonas Salk, in a laboratory in the University of Pittsburgh, which was not a very prestigious medical school at that time, with a handful of associates, made the polio vaccine and tested it initially. Well, they made it in 3.5 months and then began testing it. And in 3.5 years had completed all the testing, and it was a proven vaccine. And that wasn't done by a large pharmaceutical firm. That wasn't done at a research institute. That was done in a little laboratory with a handful of investigators. That, to me, is incredible. The second that's incredible that you're alluding to is this trial was funded completely by the public through their dimes. So I grew up, and maybe you still remember bits of it, during the era of the March of Dimes campaign, where you couldn't look at a dime without putting it in a box to support polio research. So that all of Salk's research, and in fact most of the polio research, was funded through the March of Dimes. That was a public group. And then furthermore, the trial, the largest trial in American history that included over 1.5 million children, was totally carried out by volunteers, housewives, volunteer nurses, high school principals. They had an army of volunteers, not some large research organization that did this. So it really was quite incredible. And they kept all the data on little data cards and sent it to the University of Michigan, where it was tabulated. An incredible time.
Well, let's get back to 1955, the summer of 1955. What happened?
Well, on April 12th, let me scroll back 1 second. Jonas Salk made the vaccine. He knew that it was going to prevent polio, but one had to do a large trial in order to test that. He did not do that trial. The National Foundation, March of Dimes, literally took it out of his hands and had someone else conduct the trial. And Thomas Francis, who was a very senior virologist, collect all the data and analyze the results. So Salk, for an entire year from the beginning of the trial in April of 1954, did not, until the morning of the announcement, did not know the results of that trial. Shame on them for that. But so on April 12th, 1955, at Ann Arbor, Michigan, where Thomas Francis had his group that was doing the analysis, made the announcement that, in fact, the vaccine had reduced polio, paralytic polio, by about 80%, 80 to 90%, depending on the type. Salk got up and spoke after that. Salk didn't know until breakfast that morning with Francis and with the head of the National Foundation that the trial had been effective. He knew it would be in his heart, but he didn't know how effective it was going to be. And then he got up and spoke. And the country went crazy. Church bells rang. People wrote, "Thank you, Dr. Salk," on their store windows. There were prayer meetings across the country. It was as if there was the end of a war, many people have said. That was the celebration. And Salk became an international hero, in part because the media had made him the icon for polio. There were many other people involved along the way, but he became the icon for polio. And Edward R. Murrow said to him that evening, "Son, a great misfortune has fallen upon you." Or I'm paraphrasing. And he said, "What's that?" And he said, "You have just lost your anonymity." Salk had no idea what that meant, but his life changed from that moment forward.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, a professor emerita at Stanford University School of Medicine and former director of the Clinical Cancer Center. You may know her from her earlier book, Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease. She's here today with Jonas Salk, A Life. The whole idea that a scientist becomes this incredible celebrity is something that it could be anyone, but we can create celebrities now in 10 seconds. But when a celebrity is created in the face of all this fear, what is happening to our children? How do we protect them? There's a higher intensity of celebrity that I think we need to appreciate.
Absolutely. In fact, there weren't very many physician celebrities at all. Pasteur, actually, was one, and he was one of Salk's role models. Jonas Salk didn't really anticipate that he would become a celebrity, a rock star of science, nor did he aspire to that. He honestly thought that he'd go home that day and start working in the laboratory the next day. The appreciation that ricocheted around the world just flabbergasted him. So within a month of that announcement, he or the University of Pittsburgh on his behalf received 10,000 letters and telegrams and phone calls. And Jonas Salk felt really beholden to the public. He felt they needed to know everything along the way, that they needed to be listened to because they had supported his research. So he initially tried to respond to every letter, which became absolutely impossible. And heads of states wanted to give him awards. Every little club around the United States, from the Elks Club here to the Rotary Club there to the Women's Sewing Club. He finally had to limit it only to those societies to which he belonged, or obviously heads of states and very sentinel things. And he felt bad about that. He really did feel bad about that. He wanted to thank the public as much as possible.
Now, you can have a good vaccine, you can have a good clinical trial, but now you've got to get to manufacturing, and you've got to manufacture it and distribute it, and it has to all be perfect. What happened?
So during the trial, the vaccine, which was a killed virus vaccine, so you had to make sure all those virus were killed or you could give the person polio. All of that vaccine was made by just a handful of pharmaceutical companies, and every batch was tested by them. and was tested by the government laboratory and was tested by Jonas Salk himself. And he actually went around to those laboratories. He inspected them. He made all the manufacturing guidelines. He had his thumb on the entire process. And there was not a single child out of that 1.5 million who developed polio or any major side effect from the vaccine. That vaccine, after that announcement that very day, it received approval and a vaccine was starting to be shipped out the next day. Now, the manufacturers were no longer at that moment in time under the control of the government and certainly were cut away from Jonas Salk and from the National Foundation. And his process for killing the vaccine was a little bit cumbersome. And one company in particular, Cutter Laboratories, which is here in Berkeley, decided to change the procedure just a tad. And suddenly calls started coming in of children developing polio, which was an enormous, because now there was a national polio vaccination program ongoing, and suddenly their children getting polio. And no one knew what was going on at that moment in time. They rushed everyone to Washington to talk it over. They did not include Jonas Salk in that discussion. They included some of the other senior polio scientists who had been against his vaccine to begin with. And there was an attempt to halt the program. They began, of course, the epidemiologists at CDC began, it wasn't called the CDC then, but essentially the CDC tracked down most of the cases to the Cutter Laboratory. There were a few other cases from some other manufacturers, and the program was halted. And they began to investigate and could find nothing the matter. And Jonas Salk knew the problem had to be with that company. He knew it. And so he went there himself, and he realized that they had changed a filtration process, just some minor changes that had allowed some live vaccine, a live virus to get through into the vaccine. And very quickly, that was modified, and the program was initiated again. Now, that couldn't happen today because the federal government has very, very strict manufacturing guidelines. But that was just so disheartening to Salk, because on the one hand, he was just devastated that someone would get polio from his vaccine, just devastated. On the other hand, the senior scientists who had opposed him now shook their finger at him and said, "See, we told you so."
Millions of children everywhere are taking this vaccine. How soon thereafter did the first one start to develop polio?
It was within a few days. It was very quick.
Very quick.
Because so, live polio was injected into some of the children.
Some of these children. Okay, so.
Well, the arguments that were going back and forth, most of the anger was really focused on the Surgeon General, who one day was saying the vaccine's safe, the next day was saying, well, maybe not, well, maybe we'll do this, and was wavering back and forth. And the American public actually, the public didn't blame Salk. They looked to Salk for advice. Many letters came in saying, please tell us what to do. Should we take the vaccine when the program reopens? It was the senior scientists who were using this as a means to further criticize Salk's work.
We have all this tremendous success. It just took a couple of months to get the manufacturing straight so that we knew the vaccine was right. Were all the children vaccinated?
Not all. And that was very frustrating for Jonas Salk because he thought that it was a moral obligation for us to protect our children. But after the vaccine program opened back up, Boston did not reopen its vaccination program because one of the senior scientists was from Boston and warned against it. They had a major outbreak that summer, and almost 2,000 children were paralyzed. And that was just heartbreaking, again, to Jonas Salk. Vaccination was not mandatory. So there were parents who chose not to have their children vaccinated because there were all kinds of rumors about how it could be dangerous to their child. And there was another problem. The government didn't handle the transition from the March of Dimes vaccinating people to now this being out on the free market. So they ran out of vaccine. They ran out of vaccine very quickly in the midst of this whole Qatar incident going on. So the first few months were pretty rocky because here they were coming into the summer of 1955. Now there was a vaccine that was available to protect children, but there wasn't enough of it around. That was a major, major problem for parents. They would try to get it on the black market. They would there was only enough vaccine for children. Some adults would try to steal it from companies and get it for themselves. So it was a terrible time. There was price gouging by private physicians.
All the things that make us human.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's a standard story, if you will. Something that you did mention in there that I think weighs heavily on being a scientist is how we had many scientists actually working in many ways on this vaccine, on a vaccine. Everyone wanted a vaccine for polio. And not all the scientists agreed with Salk. This was a really big challenge.
The majority of senior scientists did not agree with Salk. And here was the issue. The other three vaccines that were available at that time, starting with the smallpox vaccine, were all made from a weakened live virus. And the majority of senior scientists, or scientists in general, believed that you had to have a vaccine made from a live weakened virus in order to have lifetime protection, that you had to have this kind of mini subliminal infection. Salk believed that you could use a killed virus and get rid of any of the potential toxicity while achieving immunity. And he had shown that with the influenza vaccine, which he had worked on prior to the polio vaccine. So he disagreed in that regard. Now, the National Foundation March of Dimes was supporting the research of a group of scientists who were all working together, a committee on immunization, which included Albert Sabin and a whole slew of very senior scientists. Salk was one of the most junior members. And so he, with the blessings of the director of the National Foundation, Basil O'Connor, he concocted and tested his killed virus vaccine really in secret, not telling the other scientists, because he knew that they would try to derail him. And when at one of their meetings, he finally presented his data, and Basil O'Connor and some of the others wanted now to go full bore and do this large national trial. Many of the scientists were, one, flabbergasted that he had done this, and two, totally opposed. They could not believe that this was the vaccine that was really going to protect polio.
I'm speaking with Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, the author of Jonas Salk, A Life. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at TechNation.com, Stitcher, iTunes, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, developing new treatments for Meniere's disease. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You are listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, the author of Jonas Salk, A Life.
Now, the National Foundation March of Dimes was supporting the research of a group of scientists who were all working together, a committee on immunization, which included Albert Sabin and a whole slew of very senior scientists. Salk was one of the most junior members. And so he, with the blessings of the director of the National Foundation, Basil O'Connor, he concocted and tested his killed virus vaccine really in secret, not telling the other scientists, because he knew that they would try to derail him. And when at one of their meetings, he finally presented his data, and Basil O'Connor and some of the others wanted now to go full bore and do this large national trial. Many of the scientists were, one, flabbergasted that he had done this, and two, totally opposed. They could not believe that this was the vaccine that was really going to protect polio. And Albert Sabin, who we'll come to later, was one of the major, major opponents.
It's later. Let's come to Albert Sabin.
So Albert Sabin, along with a few others, were working on an oral vaccine because they used a live weakened virus, so now you could swallow it. But he couldn't do his trials in the United States now because the majority of the kids were now getting vaccinated. So he did most of his trials in Russia and several other countries. And he was a very bright scientist and had an oral vaccine then that could prevent polio. Now, many of the others in the scientific community thought, this is great. We're behind you, Sabin, because we all believe that you have to have a weakened virus. And in the early 60s, despite all of Salk's efforts to the contrary, the Surgeon General and then the government approved his vaccine and made it the vaccine of choice, citing convenience, because it's in a sugar cube now, and cost. And in fact, Salk's vaccine got shunted aside, and by 1968, it was not even manufactured in the United States anymore. So lo and behold, what happens? Well, just as Salk had predicted, some of those weakened viruses mutated and became more virulent. And in fact, there were cases of polio from people that got the oral vaccine. Not only just from them, but if you were a parent and you didn't have protection because you had not been immunized and your child got the oral vaccine, they would shed the virus in their feces. And if you changed the child's diaper, you might be able to get polio from that. So the numbers were small. Sabin would never concede that those cases were from the oral vaccine. He was a very very eminent scientist, and the scientific community stood behind him. And really throughout the entire rest of his life, Jonas Salk approached all the major medical decision makers. He worked through the government. He worked through lawyers. He finally got the media on his side. He worked so hard to get that vaccine delicensed and a reversion to the killed virus vaccine. That only happened after his death.
I have to say in reading this book that the strength of character to not just do what he did in terms of producing this vaccine, but over time to fight the scientific community, this group or this person distance themselves from. So it's such an isolating experience from a media, from a public persona point of view. It seemed like he's a hero, but to be isolated in the scientific community and to be fought that way, what a tremendous burden.
It was, I think. Of course, there are always two sides to the story. So why, when he was getting all these awards from heads of states around the country, he received almost nothing from the scientific community. There are very few even notes of congratulation. They were ominously silent. He didn't get the Nobel Prize. Okay, one might say, well, maybe it wasn't prize worthy. But he wasn't even, he was blackballed from the National Academy of Sciences, and he made one of the major contributions to medicine. So one has to ask why. Well, part of it was just purely this disagreement that he had really done this work behind their back and disproven what was almost this religious belief by scientists. That was one. The second was that the public did go crazy over him. And here this announcement was made. Normally you would write up and publish your results in a very standard manner and then go and give some talks about it. This was on television. There were hordes of reporters and radio. It was a major, major event. And the scientists had not been able to review the results yet. And so that there was so much hoopla, it was described as a circus, as bedlam by the scientists. They said it debased medicine. The third thing that happened is because Salk had become the icon and was so beloved by the media, they criticized him for grabbing the limelight, for not mentioning all the other scientists whose work formed the basis for his ability to make the vaccine. Now, in fact, he had mentioned many of those people, but the public didn't want to read about Tom Enders and Dorothy Horseman. Who were they? They wanted to know about Jonas Salk. He was their hero. And so, in a sense, the media created some of that problem, and the public, obviously, themselves. The third was, as I mentioned, he felt beholden to the public. So he gave interviews for Parent magazine. I mean, what serious scientist gives an interview for Parent magazine? He went on television and showed them how he made his vaccine and used a wearing blender. He talked about, likened his vaccine to baking a cake. And if you gave your recipe to the neighbor and they changed it a bit and it didn't taste like yours, and then they complained you gave them the wrong recipe, that's how he explained the Cutter incident. Well, the scientific community just couldn't stand that. That was terrible. He was a man who...
We'd give him an award today just yeah. for explaining it in a way people could understand.
Exactly. But then the walls of academia were very high. Very high. And he was a physician scientist. I mean, he did have the heart of a physician as well. But the walls of academia were high. Scientists didn't behave that way. He lacked academic decorum, they felt. And... So I think those were some. Now, he contributed to that. He contributed by reaching out to the public. He contributed to that because he didn't write in a standard scientific way. So if you read any of his early articles, he didn't do the usual introduction, methods, results, interpretation. He would just wax prolific and use metaphors. I mean, he didn't even write like a standard scientist should write. So there were... quite a number of reasons.
And, you know, campaigning against someone's vaccine, someone's treatment which has been approved, is not going to win you friends in the community.
No, but he was already a bit of a, I use the word outcast, which his son doesn't like, but he was already a bit of an outcast in the scientific community at that time. And I think that's why no one listened to him. In a sense, they'd kind of nod and see him outside the door and, you know, whisper to their secretary, don't let him in, that sort of thing, because he was tenacious. He was like a dog with a bone. He would not let up on that. And he repeated himself over and over again. He just would not give up.
And you mentioned his son. Of course, he had a number of children and his first wife. They lived through all of this, going from being a scientist at the University of Pittsburgh to worldwide fame. That affects everyone in the family.
Absolutely. So he did have three sons, and his wife was a very, very accomplished, brilliant woman who was a social worker, but she stopped working when the children were born. He was never home. He started working on the influenza vaccine during the war and then went on to the polio vaccine. And in a sense, she really believed in him. She thought he was going to make big changes. She was very, very supportive. But I think she thought when it was done that then she'd reclaim him. It's interesting, there are pictures of him reading with his three sons or flying a kite. He never did any of that. In fact, when the kids got in high school, they were sent east to boarding schools. She was a bit of an introvert. She just could not deal with all of the celebrity. She didn't want to go to parties. She hated it when the newspapers would call her and ask her, you know, what did your husband eat for breakfast? I think even more the children suffered from the celebrity, particularly his older son, Peter, who was quite shy. He couldn't play Little League. You know, he was expected to hit home runs every time because he was Jonas Salk's son. He was Peter Salk. So it was very, very difficult for them. But the break between his wife had been going on for many years. He just kept moving on to his next mountain, and he didn't take her with him.
And yet he has a very famous second marriage, and that second marriage has a structure that is not typical.
Yes, so he married François Gillot, an accomplished French artist, whose book Life with Picasso sold millions, as she described her life as Picasso's mistress. And in fact, that's how many people knew of her. And she was visiting friends and met Jonas Salk in La Jolla at the Salk Institute. He was taken by her. He was now divorced, so this was not a reason for the breakup in his marriage. He was taken with her and pursued her. She wondered what in the world did she want with a stuffy scientist. But on the other hand, he was a hero in France. I mean, he was her family just talked on and on about Jonas Salk. Eventually, they were on the same wavelength, the same plane. They both sought refuge from the world and saw each other as an island they could swim
and
to.
And she understood celebrity.
She understood celebrity. She also, as his sister-in-law said, she Frenchified him. He suddenly didn't look like a little nerdy scientist. He let his hair grow long. He wore silk scarves around his neck. He took yoga. He began to eat better. He was healthier. But they did have an agreement, one of many. This was only one she told me, that she could only needed to stay in San Diego 6 months a year, that she had a studio in New York and one in Paris, and that she needed to be alone to do her work. And that was fine with him. He agreed to everything. He just...
Oh, I like that.
In fact, when they were at a restaurant in San Diego overlooking the ocean at sunset when he proposed, and she said, well, I can't marry you. There are just too many objections. So he handed her a piece of paper, and he said, okay, I want you to write down all of your musts. then he left the room and came back later and stood there and read them all, shook his head and said, yes, I can agree with all of these.
Now, of course, Dr. Salk was always associated with polio, but many people don't know that in the end, he was working on a vaccine for HIV.
Yes. He actually was involved in a number of other diseases, I should say, before then. First, he was one of the co-developers of the first influenza vaccine. He also worked on cancer and multiple sclerosis, neither of which panned out. But he was 70 years old. His lab had already been closed at the Salk Institute when young men began dying of this mysterious disease, and he was very troubled about it, very troubled about AIDS, And one of his friends said, well, why don't you jump in there? Nobody's making a vaccine. And he said, I don't want to be part of all that meanness again, which I think says something for his prior experience. But a young man came to him, and the two of them formed a company, Immune Response. And he had the idea of making a vaccine, very similar to the way he made the polio vaccine, with the human immunodeficiency virus, and give it to people actually who already had been infected as a way to prolong the period between infection and their development of full-blown AIDS, and then, in fact, hoping to block the development of AIDS altogether. He was scorned by many who thought he was just tilting at windmills, an old man.
Same old.
Yeah, exactly. But he did two, I think when one comes to the history of HIV, he did two important things. The first he did was, there was a major argument that went on between Robert Gallo, the American scientist, and Montagnier in France, both who claimed that they had discovered the HIV, the virus. And it was blown up to an international incident almost. And Saul took it upon himself to very quietly play the role of Solomon and to get the two to come to an agreement about what the story would be and a joint owning of that glory of finding the virus. So that was very important. And secondly, because every conference that he went to, the media still followed him around like a rock star, which, of course, annoyed the younger scientists. And what he did was he brought attention to the disease. He legitimized it. He led the public to realize this wasn't a problem about gay men, that this was a disease that they all had to reckon with. And I think that maybe is the most important thing he did for HIV. His vaccine, by the way, they were arguing with the FDA about how they were going to put the trial together to prove its effectiveness. They had already had some preliminary trials that looked quite good at USC, but they now needed to do a big national trial. And the FDA had put up a lot of roadblocks at the time that Salk died. So he never saw the vaccine in a trial.
Well, Charlotte, there's 559 pages here. We've just skimmed a few of the points. I'd have such a hard time putting these questions, like, what do we talk about in the middle of all this? But it's absolutely fascinating from many different angles. And I want to thank you for coming in.
I have one question for you.
Sure.
Did you get the Salk vaccine?
I do remember the issue about the you don't have to have a shot, you can have a sugar cube instead. So everybody thought sugar cubes were pretty good. But I do remember the polio business. And I do remember, young people who had been, who had suffered polio and recovered as teenagers. They had, you know, things that covered their arms or their legs so you wouldn't see the withering. And then it was a real thing. So they're still, that generation of parents still talked about it with great fear. So, Charlotte, please come back, see us anytime. We'd love
Thank
to see you.
You
again. My guest today is Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, a professor emerita at Stanford University School of Medicine and former director of the Clinical Cancer Center. She's here today with Jonas Salk, A Life. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we talk about Meniere's disease and how a venture capitalist decided there should be better treatment options right from his initial diagnosis. Avalon Ventures' Jay Lichter is a co-founder of Autonomy. I started out by asking him, what is Meniere's disease?
Yeah, Meniere's is a very debilitating disease. I first started getting the symptoms, it was probably April or so of 2007. I had some hearing loss in one ear, and it was sort of the family joke at one point. But then about January or so of 2008, I got my first vertigo spell, which is one of the hallmarks of Meniere's disease. And it was very strange. It was very dizzy, and I couldn't get up. I couldn't walk. I was driving at the time. I had to pull over. And quite frankly, I thought I was going to die. I didn't know if I had a stroke or a heart attack or what. So after about 20 minutes when I was still alive, I was able to call a friend. And she picked me up and took me to the emergency room. And in the end, got into the clinic at UCSD. A fellow named Jeff Harris, who's the head of otolaryngology at UCSD, and he said, "You have Meniere's disease." And I said, "Okay.
What's that?
What's that?" Exactly.
Now that I'm alive.
Now that I'm not
what's
dead.
What's the bad news?
and he said, it's a peculiar disease of vertigo, tinnitus, hearing loss, and what's called oral fullness, like you have water in your ear or something. And those are the four hallmark symptoms. And for me, the first, I don't know, maybe 4 or 6 months, I would have 2 to 3 vertigos a week, each one lasting between 8 and 10 hours. And can't get out of bed, nothing, just sort of close your eyes and lie there. And the weird thing is that once the vertigo ends, you have this thing called a brain fog, or I used to call it a vertigo hangover. And that would last several hours where you're not spinning still, but you're just in this weird fog phase where your mind isn't really sharp. But I was fortunate during that time that because when I asked Jeff, I said, "So, you know, what are the treatment options?" And he said, "Well, there aren't any FDA-approved products for Meniere's disease. There's, you know, what some people do is they'll inject steroid into the ear, you know, through the eardrum and inject a steroid. And some people get benefit from that. Otherwise, we do surgery and we cut the nerve and you'll be deaf, but you won't have any vertigo." And I wasn't really in favor of that surgery. The problem with the steroids at that point was they were water-based. And so when you inject a liquid into the ear, it just drips out the eustachian tube. So maybe for a few hours, you can get exposure to the drug. In the times between when I was having vertigo, we figured out that you could, we were inventing this, wrote a bunch of patents, you could have a gel system that at room temperature is a liquid, and then you inject it and it turns into a gel.
And then, because it's hotter inside your body.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it turned to a gel once it hit your body temperature, and then you'd have release of the drug for 3 months. So that's really, you know, the basis of the drug. And
actually, the step here is that most people that don't know, they know you get the Meniere's, but they don't know that you're a biotech venture capitalist.
Yeah.
So it's like, what's the first thing you do? It's like, well, we got to get a drug.
We got to figure this out.
I mean,
I was very lucky because most people actually don't get diagnosed right away because while it's a relatively common disease, almost as common as multiple sclerosis, most people have never heard of it. And, you know, if you just go to a general practitioner, if you don't go, even an ENT who's not an otolaryngologist who doesn't really know, maybe they think it's, you know, just benign positional vertigo, which you sort of shake your head around and it'll go away. And maybe 10 or 15% of people have an episode like that in their life. So that's reasonably common. But Meniere's is a tough disease to get diagnosed. And so I was just fortunate that I happened out of sheer luck to get with Jeff Harris, who's one of the world's experts in Meniere's.
How did you get from, I've been diagnosed with the disease, my treatment options are not any that I really prefer, we have to be able to do this better. How did you move into starting Autonomy?
Well, I don't know, it's just in my blood to start companies. It really is. I've started probably 25 or so biotech companies in my life, some number like that. And, you know, it's not a problem. It's an opportunity, right? I guess making lemonade sort of thing. But you know, I was very focused because I couldn't really have my regular day job. I was CEO of a bunch of companies and I was doing the best I can to manage that. And I was okay. But it was really bothering me that I had this problem and that there were, you know.
It could happen at any time.
It could happen at any time. And that's really the scary part. You know, there's two things that are really horrible about it. One is you could be perfectly fine 1 second and the next second, bang, you're down. And the other thing is trying to explain to people what you actually have because people don't understand. They think, you know, they see you walking around dizzy and they think you're drunk, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, that's not the case. And it's terrible. There's, like I said, probably a million people in the United States afflicted with this and nobody really knows.
So when did you start working on the improvement?
From the very first meeting with my doctor, Jeff Harris. He told me the treatment options, they weren't very good. And I said, you know, I'm a pharmaceutical scientist. I'm a venture capitalist. I start companies in San Diego and have for 15 years. And this one obviously is very important to me. You know, at that time, I didn't realize how common the disease was. But, you know, now in hindsight, it's a huge impact. And so we just started that conversation after talking about my treatment options, talking about, all right, well, what can we do to make it better?
And I love how the concept of a doctor saying, I'm explaining to you how many times in his career has he said, here's your option one, two, three. And the first thing the guy says, oh, we got to make that better. And we're going to do it. You know what?
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of patients that say, no, I want something better. But are they able to actually do it?
Can they perform? Can they perform?
Yeah. So we started the company and we wrote 25 patents. And I was still very, very sick at the time. And so I would go in and out of being able to work on the stuff. But what I realized quickly was, you know, nobody had written any patents on anything about the ear. There was just absolutely nothing. It was a wide open space. And, you know, from a business standpoint, you step back and you go, it's fantastic. It's 20 to 30 million Americans with middle and inner ear disorders, 8,000 physicians that treat them. And, I mean, it was perfect. And nobody, not a single drug company, nobody making drugs, nobody detailing to them. All it was a surgical profession, right? It was new ways of cutting tissue or new ways of you know, resecting bone area or whatever. So it was really a very perfect opportunity, probably the last opportunity of a specialty that didn't have any drug development work.
So I love this idea of you take a liquid drug, and when it gets in your ear, mm-hmm. it warms up and becomes a gel.
Mm-hmm.
That
doesn't sound like ice, does it? No.
No. It's a very different
kind of... Well, that was our second choice. Our first choice, which failed, was chitosan, you know, the gel stuff in shrimp.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you take that, you extract it from the shrimp, and you add some stimulatory action that would turn it to a gel. And so we had this system set up where you would mix it or something and it would turn into a gel in the ear. And it was terrible. It was terrible. And the biggest problem is that the quality of the chitosan would ebb and flow based on the quality of the shrimp harvest that particular season. So it was just never going to be – I know, it was never going to be a pharmaceutical product. But then we came across this thing called poloxamer, which is it's just a polymer that when you heat it up, the activation energy takes these little short polymers and takes them to very long ones. And it's completely reversible. So you can take something, poloxamer, room temperature, and mix it around, heat it up. It turns, you know, jello. Then you cool it back down. It turns back to – it's actually more like honey. So that's what it was. It's like a honey versus jello. And
now, is that a platform? Can you put different drugs
into it? Yeah, exactly. We added. And so it's the steroid for Meniere's. We have an antibiotic for pediatric recurrent ear infection. In fact, we had phase 3 data last year, and that's now submitted – in an NDA to the FDA. Currently, they're reviewing it. We expect them to approve it hopefully this year, and we'll start selling it next year if all goes well.
I have a list of diseases I want you to get, Jay.
Well, the next one is then we have tinnitus is next on the list. And I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff there. And it's a great opportunity. And like I said, we were fortunate to sort of stumble upon an area that was sort of wide open. And of course, having a very personal interest to me.
Well, Jay, thanks so much for coming in again, and please come back. See us anytime. Keep us updated.
Absolutely. Love talking to you. Thanks.
Jay Lichter is a venture capitalist with Avalon Ventures and a co-founder of Autonomy. More information about Autonomy is available at autonomy.com. That's OTONOMY, autonomy.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.